Thank you all for coming. Thanks for the organizers for the invitation. Although the new bill on rape was brought to Parliament a year ago, demanding immediate attention, the discussion began on the 20th of February 1984. After 150 years of existence, the Greek state introduced a bill that, among many other fundamental issues, dealt with intramarital rape. An MP of the Progressives protested, "The House of the Parliament should only occupy itself with serious problems. So how is it possible to occupy with intramarital rape?" The same MP argued again later against the legal equation of rape and forced sodomy. "Since sodomy does not result in pregnancy, what kind of danger does it induce to society?" 23 days later, the new law on rape passed with a big majority of votes. However, other equally important provisions, such as the one in question over intramarital rape, were turned down. This little incident is telling with regard to the greater picture in terms of rape law in Greek history. As the time approaches that the Greek state will celebrate its 200 years old of existence, the legislation on rape still struggles to gain its proper status among other crimes against individuals included in the penal code. Evidently, rape is not a common crime. It delves into power relations and gender social hierarchies, control and discipline. Its legislative imprint is entangled in centuries-old discussions over womanhood, individual rights, mores, sexuality, and sexualized violence, and also the limits of legal interpretation. In the coming years, as it concerns my part of our research project with Dimitra Vasiliadou and Tasos Kostopoulos, I will trace the legal meanings of rape in the country from 1832 to 1960s. Today I will provide a short overview of the legislation on rape from the very beginning of the Greek state until recently, that is July 2019. While in parallel, I share some thoughts on the historical turning points of the respective legislation. Even though we all deal with it daily, law remains an unknown and unfriendly area for the non-experts. Causes fear, nervousness, anger, and even suspicion, emitting an objective and impartial type of knowledge that allegedly resembles to positivist sciences like mathematics, and keeps us safe, even arrogant, distance from other social sciences. Law, let me say that these were some of the features of the law that let me keep myself distant from the legal professions. Law, similarly to medicine, stands as one of these fields of knowledge that exercise a gaze over the entirety of social life and provides tools for a certain kind of survival in the modern world. However, I will insist today, through the example of legislation on rape, on the other side of the law, let's say that, which is its fluidity, its socio-historical relativity, exposing the extent on which it relies on interpretation and exploring the fragility behind the solidity of texts. Of course, these features of the law also exist, and I'm happy to see here Mr. Douzinas, where in Bilbek, while studying there, I discovered myself in this program, Human Rights, these features of the law there, which show the socio-historical relativity of law. The law in Greece draws from the tradition of the continental written use, mostly influenced by the German law. The jurist Georg Ludwig von Mauler brought to the country at the era of the first king of Greece, the 17-year-old Otto, in 1832. Apart from the international laws to which the country abides by, Greece's judiciary is divided between the private law, the private jurisprudence and the public jurisprudence. When we say private jurisprudence, we mean civil, labor, and commercial law. When we refer to public jurisprudence, we mean constitutional, administrative, fiscal, ecclesiastic, penal, and process law. So we are at the, in the area of public jurisprudence, the penal law. The three basic written sources of rules of penal law can be found in three books: Penal Code, Special Penal Laws, and Code of Penal Process. Beyond these pillars of written legislation, two more subsidiary sources of penal law are legal theory, produced by experts, like professors in law schools, and judicial practice, the interpretation of law by judges in trials. I'm explaining all this because I have to do the legal landscape first. All these three pillars, legislation, legal theory, and judicial practice, communicate in all cases that interpretation is needed due to a certain obscurity. The penal code has changed only four times in the history of the Greek state, that is 1834, 1950, 1984, and 2019. Today's penal code contains three books. The first book includes the general principles on crimes and processes of the penal law. And the third book connects the code with other special penal laws like terrorism or drugs, guns. Finally, the second book, which is what mostly concerns us now, includes 270 articles and 23 chapters, divides the crimes in three basic categories depending on the gravity: minor offenses, misdemeanors, and felonies. The 18th chapter refers to crimes against personal freedom, as a, for example, abduction, trafficking, attacks, etc. And the 20th chapter to crimes against family, for example, bigamy, abandonment of pregnant women, etc. Between these chapters, the one against personal freedom and the other against family, crimes against family, lies the 19th chapter, which is crimes against sexual freedom and crimes of economic exploitation of sexual life. The first article, 336, defines rape, while the subsequent ones refer to offenses of sexual dignity, incest, pedophilia, child sex work, and child pornography. Obviously, the way these issues are set in the respective chapters is telling of the meaning rape is given among offenses against personhood and those against family. So, the way to analyze laws of rape is to see the ways they appear in the penal code and are discussed in legal theory. This is what I will try to do today, adding a few comments on the social historical context of this of the produced legislation. In 1824, a penal law is created for the first time. It's not called penal code, but it's considered to be deeply inspired by the progressive European legal thought of the Enlightenment. However, there's no radical change in it from earlier conception of women. The offense of rape against women ranges depending on the magnitude of the offense inflicted upon women's male relatives. If a widow is abducted, there's no rape, it's an abduction in this law. If a widow is abducted, a man is threatened with, the perpetrator, threatened with 1 year in prison. While if a virgin is abducted, the sentence can reach 5 years imprisonment and 6 years in the case of a married woman. Someone can tell apart a virgin from a woman with the condition of a small hymen in the vagina. An orifice of the hymen is called in Greek kori, which also means maiden, and further brings us to Greek difficult Greek words like parthenothoria or echorexis, which I can only in an abstract way give in English, like deflowering. They describe the destruction of this virgin hymen. The existence of this hymen was apparently a matter of ultimate importance for society and marriage at the era. In 1835, Reid was punished in Article 273 in the 15th chapter of the First Penal Code, which is entitled On Damage of the Mors, including articles on seduction, lewdness, intemperance, incest, sodomy, bigamy, and adultery. The victim, that could be male or female in this first penal code, was protected independent of its virginity, marital status, etc. So this is a big change in, at the 1835 law. The extent of the punishment will depend on occasions that other crimes agglomerated, such as severe physical damage, murder, or in cases of juvenile victims. The penal law excluded compensations in favor of the family of the victim, as it would happen in earlier periods, when virginity was considered as part of family property. Thus, in this first law of the Greek state, we observe a shift. I insist that it is a shift in the legal texts, not in what happening at societies in rural Greece or in urban Greece. But we observe a shift from a perception of the rape victim as an object belonging to the man of the family to one where she is considered a subject with her own freedom and honor. Nonetheless, still the opinions differ of who suffers most from rape. Is it the family, the community, or the victim itself? Since rape is not anymore a crime against property, it is debated whether it is foremost one against individual rights, public order, or community ethics. Traces of this change can be found in the respective developments in the state of Bavaria and its laws on Mors, 1813, 1827, 1831. With 1835 legislation in Greece, seduction to lewdness is meant as a sexual offense, not including intercourse. Sodomy is given in Greek with the phrase paraphysin aselgia, which could be given in English like unnatural seduction to lewdness. The term includes pedophilia, sodomy, intercourse between men or between women, and bestiality. Rape was still discussed in the penal code next to other crimes as adultery and prostitution. So it was connected with sexuality rather than violent crimes in general. The mix of a man, I'm reading a quote from a legal theory book, the mix of a man and a woman comes with their free will or against their will. When it occurs with their free will, but with a reward, it's called prostitution. When it occurs between one or more of married individuals, it is referred to as adultery. When it occurs against the will, with the use of violence, it is referred to as rape. Rape in legal theory is split into three categories: rape of a virgin, rape of a woman, and rape of a man. So we see that virginity appears as a factor in legal theory books. And all these crimes are referred to sexuality in one way or the other, with violence or marriage and other factors. I will explain some of these a bit later. Virginity is always still an issue of discussion among legal experts and, of course, doctors. Dr. Lagos writes in 1883 that among Greeks, among Greek people, virginity was considered as a social possession and nobody was allowed to corrupt it. Preservation of virginity is called by society honor, timi in Greek, which also means price. And the young woman that preserves it is called honorable. And what is more valuable for a young woman than offering her husband her honor? Indeed, only virginity can be set under the young woman's power and free will, while in all other matters she remains minor. End of quote. The preservation of the virginity hymen is proof of a woman's loyalty. The existence of the virginity hymen is critical in legal cases, says Dr. Lagos, since if it is not broken or destroyed, we are not encountering a case of rape, but instead attempted rape. Some 30 years later, however, Coroner McAleese will dispute this opinion, providing statistics of 55 young women that visited the coroner's office in the first semester of 1911, and although many were raped, their hymen remained intact. According to McAleese, rape and seduction include penetration, although in rape this takes place with brutality and in seduction with deceitful means. For example, the perpetrator promises to marry the victim, as was the case usually. McAleese argues that the real virginity sets its unbreakable throne not on the impact of a fragile membrane, but in the integrity and whiteness of the entirety of the soul. Virginity is something of a moral quality rather than of natural traits, which might be deceitful. The body might be deceitful. Nevertheless, 2 months before McAleese's book, the Parliament voted a change in penal code in law 3841 in 1911, which regulated that if a man has taken advantage of an experience or trust of a juvenile maiden of impeccable morals and deceives her to achieve sexual intercourse, he is punished with 6 months to 1 year in prison. The man remains unpunished in case he marries the deceit. So we see many decades after the 1835 law that the rituals, the mores in Greek society give another a different direction of how that bring the law with them. Finally, I will say. Sorry for that interruption, I will explain later. In the next four decades, until 1950, judges are called to interpret the notion of an impeccable mores in each case, based more on the perception of dominant social ethics and less on anatomy. That is what I want to insist on right now. In 1927, professors Iliopoulos and Horafas, law professors, referred for first time to the right on free will communication of gender. In 1492 penal law in 1950, 1 year after the end of the Greek Civil War, Article 336 on rape remains in the familiar chapter of the code, crimes against mores. However, in this new penal code, rape breaks in three different crimes: rape, forced lewdness, and abuse. Rape is punished more severely and takes place only against married women. The penal code still contains articles on the abduction of virgins and adulteries. Aselkia, which is difficult to translate the word, but I have translated it as forced lewdness. So, aselgia is described as a sexual contact, not intercourse. For example, Professor Magakis writes, intercourse with dilating meaning is considered as a bodily speech that involves two persons of different sex. Sufficient for intercourse is the element of union, not just contact of the genitals, that is, the entry of the organ of a man in the vagina of a woman without ejaculation needed. So in the 1950 legislation, only women are considered victims of rape, while in theory it is agreed that sexual freedom, honor and physical integrity of women are equally damaged in rape. Professor Magakis notes that the damage the crimes against morals bring is found on the rules of the dominant social ethics. The legislator's mission, however, is fundamentally social and not ethical. Magakis realizes that in terms of biology, sexual life appears with great homogeneity among normal people, though when it comes to ethics and crimes against morals, it is a unique field on which so many differences are noted between different societies and different eras over what is allowed and what is forbidden to take place. These offenses are on the verge between crimes against society and crimes against the individuals. And this is what constitutes the peculiar character. This paradox leads to various problems. Forced lewdness, that is, let's say, sexual assault, is not defined in the legislative report that accompanies the penal law in 1950. Magat defines it as a gross indecency expressed with an action by the perpetrator with hedonistic motive. It is punished with maximum 10 years in prison, while rape is punished with a maximum of 20 years. Rape as a crime has two components, violence or the threat of violence and sexual intercourse. However, if a man was forced to sexual intercourse, there's no rape, but illegal violence. Punished with 10 years maximum sentence, a fact that shows the difficulty to accept the legal status of rape against men. Another paradox lies in the issue of the penal procedure of rape. Rape is the only felony in the code not prosecuted ex officio, the victim needs to be mobilized against the perpetrator and insist on her decision, because if she later changes her mind, the prosecution ends. The reason for this, according to Magakis, is that the law protects the victim from further mental injury, either coming from her social stigmatization or the trauma by repeating narration of the events of rape. The only exception in this rule lies when a case of rape creates a scandal in society to such an extent that the wider audience's sense of justice is hurt. And something that proves rape was still mostly perceived as a crime against society rather than individuals. Magetti's book is considered as one of the two theory books that laid the ground for fundamental changes in legislation. Magetti wrote his book on crimes against morals in 1967 while teaching in law school of Athens, transforming his lectures from vivid lessons of democracy and justice. Thrown out of law school and sent to jail by the military junta 2 years later, Magakis became a symbol for democratic legal experts in Greece and anti-dictatorship struggle. His old friend from Heidelberg Law School, Willy Brandt, and Chancellor of Germany at the time, achieved Magakis' release, who later became Minister of Justice after the persecution of democracy. Another influential book, the other one, was Professor Manuel Levakis, The Dialectic Notion of Rights, also written during the junta, the military junta, in 1973. Works, as the aforementioned, composed by men well educated abroad, seems to have transformed the area of morals, of the critique of morals, to an adequate vehicle of delivering critical speech against the dominant status quo. Despite the fact that women were not engaged en masse in legal professions during that era, Zoya Farnaki and Yota Kravari, two among the most prominent, appeared after the 70s, I think that we should not overlook women's presence in even in the subtexts, the textual atmosphere of legislation on wars. The women of the country experienced two massive exits from the private realm. The first one is for work in the late 19th century, and the second for collective political activity and work in mid-20th century during the German occupation and the civil war that followed. Both exits, after all, were struggles for survival. The legislation of 1911 can be read as responsive to these major events, when juvenile women workers found their ways to factories in low paid and unhealthy jobs, met with new limits in their sexuality, causing the state worry about them, producing tightly interwoven legislations on workers and juveniles. The legislation of 1950 can also be read as a response to the fact that women joined the armed resistance in the mountains, something that was considered by the right as a grave danger to social norms. In both of these exits, families seem to lose their ground from women's control over social institutions and political organizations. This trouble in traditional patriarchal status quo is possibly counterbalanced through the legislation against Morse, which maintains its vagueness and serves as a textual platform for protecting and as such controlling women. During the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, though, as a new, better educated youth is being created, producing members for the socialist center and the left, crimes against Morse also become a convenient vehicle of political criticism against the system from inside the law schools, the sometimes strongholds of conservative moralists. In this new era, the state and sensitivity can be seen fighting with this huge pressure for abstinence from tyranny. Although feminist criticism of legislation can be found in the interwar years, as Effie Abdellah and Angelica Psara have shown in their research, it was not until the restitution of democracy that the systematic feminist approach of the penal laws on rape can be found, when many young women was changing their perceptions on womanhood and gender roles based on their own political or other experiences in a fast-changing society. Many of them had arisen to form groups, discuss these experiences and spread their words or express their long-boiling anger. In 1984, at the time of the discussion on the new penal code, some feminist groups appeared with concrete demands that aimed to expand the legal definition of rape. Rape should be considered as a crime against personal freedom, not most. The prosecution should take place ex officio. No restitution of rape with marriage or money should be allowed at any social context. Non-consensual sodomy on men and women, as well as intramarital rape, should be accounted as rape. Sexual intercourse should not be reduced to penetration, and accordingly, cases of forced lewdness should also be considered as rape. The 1984 Penal Code, indeed, achieved radical reformations. Morse was boosted from the title of the familiar chapter and replaced by sexual, not personal though, freedom. Legal regulations were disconnected at large from ethical rules and their vagueness. Seduction was removed from the code and unified with rape in one crime. Professor Paraskevopoulos, a student of Manuel Levakis and former Minister of Justice, recently recognized a change in the stream of history in this 1984 change. Even if this subversion was not complete, intramarital rape, for example, would need 22 more years to be established until the law of 2006. Although the 2019 Penal Code does not include radical changes in the legal text, remains a product of a 10 years long discussion between the most prominent legal experts of Magaitis and Manuel Levakis schools. In this way, the so-called circle of metapolitics of national reconciliation after the junta closes with the magnum opus of the legal experts of the post-dictatorship era. In the 2019 legislation, in the fifth clause of the Article 336 on rape, the ministry tried to punish rape caused by psychological pressure as a misdemeanor, a change that women's organizations objected to, resulting in the withdrawal of the particular change. Instead, a clause was added punishing attempted sex without consent as a misdemeanor. However, the legislation on rape was not accompanied with wider discussion in society and law schools or at an 11, to my opinion. A certain vagueness and obscurity was maintained in its very title, Crimes Against Sexual Freedom and Crimes of Economic Exploitation of Sexual Life. So since sex working at the extent that does not include violence, it remains equated with violent actions. Furthermore, rape is still not being prosecuted ex officio, it's technical substantiation in court courtrooms also remains. Victims of rape still do not enjoy the privilege of civil action during trial. The questions posed to a victim about his former life and habits are not prohibited, as the feminists of the 1980s wanted, demanded. While the penal law defines that all felonies are prosecuted in the Trafficio, following the general principle that as heavy the forms of wrongdoing, they harm not only the victim but the entire society, in rape, by giving the option to stop the prosecution, the law admits indirectly that this felony does not hold the same gravity as others. So the paradox Margaritis was describing 50 years ago over the peculiarity of this crime remains. Last but not least, rape is still considered as a sexual crime, not a crime against personhood. The feminist groups of the 80s demanded to have female judges in rape trials and women police officers accepting the rape reports at police stations, all of them educated in gender issues. From 1989 to 2008, approximately 27 individuals were convicted with rape annually. Today, even though 10% of the police staff and almost 90% of the crime judges are women, the rape reports and convictions have not met with spectacularly higher rates. According to Agilus research, despite the fact that 4,500 rapes per year are estimated in the country, just a few find their ways to the police stations and nevertheless to courtrooms. Today, I try to show that the way the chapters of crimes are laid in the penal code does matter and reflects dominant gender perceptions. Furthermore, that rape is an exemplary field for discussing law's fluidity in the 19th and 20th century. The first royal legislation in 1835 actually a ready-made set of rules from Bavaria incorporated progressive thoughts in legal texts, namely the departure from definition of abduction to definitions of rape. As George Bugarello has shown that happened in other countries also during these years. It took 100 years, though, to decide over what kind of crime constitutes rape, a discussion that actually reflected the respective heated conversation of what constitutes woman, an object, a person, whose allegedly most valuable part of the body, a hymen, it remains society possession, or a person of full rights and autonomy over her own body. In the 20th century, the legal interpretation on rape were enriched with a gradual decline of the notion of virginity, and legislation on mores seems to have served as a contested terrain. It offered both a convenient vehicle for criticizing the dominant social ethics and the state tyranny, and a platform of legal texts behind which the state attempted to protect and control women by reassuring their position in society. Gradually, in the trajectory of the 20th century and while in the national reconciliation era, the legislation on mores decayed, giving room to the disengagement of women's personhood from their sexuality, a goal still contested, though, in the 21st century, since rape is still perceived in legal theory and the code as being on the verge of ethics and crimes, society and individuals. The legal historical discussion on rape lies on the verge of greater changes in these two centuries, ethics, ratio, religion, science, feudalism, capitalism, etc., and necessary prompts us to engage with history in terms of social conflicts that preceded and accompanied the legal constructions. The story of rape is led upon capitalist nation states governed by white males, but also marked by gaps and ruptures caused by the other half of societies. A history of laws on rape cannot be discussed in terms of conservative or progressive, though, in my opinion, it is at large a story interwoven with other stories, that of the state, the genealogy of legal profession and its experts, the feminist movement, and other areas upon which social change is produced. Law is a language of the development of all of the above, crystallized in a text that rules the life of the next generation, as a snapshot of social conflicts that become forgotten in the passage of time. Some of the names these conflicts took during the centuries were presented here: virginity, Morse, sexual freedom, etc. To hold such a view on legal formation and transformation is valuable, I think, since we understand better how the law changes and what is led underneath it. Beyond legislative bodies, legal experts, and judicial practice, it's all about social norms, interpretation, and the will to change them. And sorry for taking more time.